Back together again, you and I, brand new week, Monday, January 30th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We looked at the Memphis police beating of Tyre Nichols, who died 3 days later. The video was released a few days before we chatted on Monday. University of New Haven criminal justice professor Mike Lawler also weighed in on the Nichols case. And we were joined later on by Mark Moyer, author of Triumph Regained, the Vietnam War 1965 to 1968. Boy, that video was a tough, tough, tough watch, an emotional watch, an emotional listen. You know, you don't even have to watch it. You could just close your eyes there and listen to what's going on. But to watch it and hear what was going on with that Tyre Nichols case, man, that is a tough watch, a tough listen. You know, especially to people that understand what police have to do every day, what policemen and policewomen are tasked with every day. And even for millions of Americans who may be, and I don't know what the word is, the correct word is, desensitized or used to, but look at how many, you know, true crime police kind of live action police stuff that shows that we watch on television, starting way back with Cops on Fox in the late 1980s, getting popularity in the early 1990s. I guess the big one now was Live PD. I have a couple of friends of mine who watch all of that. And we watch that to see, you know, ostensibly good versus bad. I mean, you know, you watch that to see how cops handle people that have done some really bad things, from, you know, minor felonies or high-level misdemeanors to felonies, all the way up to shooting at cops and shooting at people. So you watch that, and you look for what the cops say, what the men and women of the police forces do in a situation. You know, you always ask yourself in a split second situation, hey, would I shoot? Would I pull the trigger? What would I do? It was last seen, I guess, in the Bristol shooting of several months ago, where that third officer, after the first two officers had been gunned down, was able to go around the back of that house and, on a severely injured leg, shoot and take out the gunman with one shot from across the lawn there, I believe, to the gunman's head. So that's the kind of thing where we look at body cam video and we marvel at what our public servants do, our policemen and policewomen, EMTs, state police, state sheriffs, and whatever states have that kind of jurisdiction. But man, that all goes out the window when you watch and you listen to the video that was released in the Tyre Nichols case. And you know what? You watch that video, and whatever you think about it, if you want to voice your anger, your frustration, your curiosity at why it happened, you can give us a call at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You know, you watch that video, you listen to it, and you ask yourself one simple, one-word question: why? Now, who knows how this is going to be defended in court with these five officers? One has a connection to Connecticut, I guess grew up, spent his teen years, his early years and teen years in Bloomfield. But you look at that and again, I hate to armchair quarterback on this stuff, because, you know, a lot of us, not all of us, because I do know we have some law enforcement folks, active duty and others, who listen to this program and call in, and I appreciate that. But man, after you watch that video, I mean, I don't know what they saw there, you know, other than the fact that I guess Tyre Nichols had run from them for a time. But, you know, you look at that from a layperson's point of view, and somebody who, as we all do, ultimately, when you watch how the money flows, you know, you watch as someone, for example, that pays the salaries of police officers, men and women in public service, and EMTs and fire people and all that. And you say to yourself, hey, I ain't paying for this. No, I'm not paying for this. And you look at that and you wonder why. What was the point? And this wasn't one officer on one person, which in no way, shape, or form would have in any way justified this. It was five guys. I guess five pretty strong guys, and now we get news that you probably heard there at the top of the hour that there was one individual, an additional officer, who I guess was not on the scene but was fired also. So there are six officers now gone from this. Five of them are going to face charges. They'll be arraigned next month. They'll have to have massive security for that. And you look at that and you say, again, you simply ask why. Now, going back to, and this was the high sign we had gotten from our local and state officials in Tennessee before they released it, you were told, we were all told, well, this is the worst thing since Rodney King. Probably was. But, you know, at least in the Rodney King thing, and again, I'm in no way, shape, or form justifying anything that happened to Rodney King. But the officers argued, and there were some even police professionals who said, when you looked at the extended video of Rodney King, you know, he wouldn't go down. If he just stayed down, they would have cuffed him. He was on PCP or angel dust or something like that. All right, whether you agree with that or not, we're several decades beyond that. But you look at the video we saw and heard, the audio and the video we saw and heard on Friday, and again, you just ask, why? What were these guys thinking? We haven't read anything. And again, we've actually read or heard very little when you think about it. I mean, the video is out there, as horrible as this is, but, you know, we didn't hear anything about Tyre Nichols leading them on a high-speed chase or an extended chase. We didn't hear anything about Tyre Nichols pointing a gun at them or pointing something when the light flickered off of it. You hear this sometimes, and, you know, cops often or sometimes mistake a cell phone for a gun. You didn't hear any of that. The only thing we heard, were five cops, for whatever reason. Again, I hearken back to the word why. Just beat the crap out of this kid. And the thing I think that is even more callous and ghoulish about it is that you had five of them doing it. And again, this comes off the whole whole George Floyd thing. We're coming up on 3 years. May will make 3 years in the George Floyd case in Minneapolis, where the remaining three officers, other than Derek Chauvin, were all criticized for not doing something. And again, and we'll talk to a law enforcement expert coming up later on to the show. Also, we'll be obviously facing this situation and covering it all week. But, you know, you just sit there and you wonder, is there a fear there? And again, I'm just kind of throwing this stuff out there because I have no idea. Again, you're not hearing any of the ancillary things that you usually hear. Well, the cops reacted, you know, the way they did because the suspect ran or brandished what the police thought was a gun or a knife or, you know, led them on a high-speed chase, or the suspect at the time was driving a vehicle that had been reported stolen out of so-and-so. We're hearing none of that. None. Which makes you ask consistently, why? What were they thinking? And, you know, it's only been a few days since the video. I mean, they released it Friday night, thank God, because if you're going to have to release something like this, it is the best time because a lot of businesses are closed on Saturday. There's no commuting. People asking online, why Friday night? Well, there's a reason for that. We'll get into that later on with Mike Lawler. But, you know, the notion is here that you're not even hearing anything about the backgrounds of these officers, too. Now, it's been 4 days, 3 or 4 days, depending on how you count it, since the video. But these officers were fired a while ago. And again, maybe the story is still developing. I don't know. But you haven't heard anything overtly aha about this. Now, there was news about one of the five, again, being growing up in Bloomfield, and one of the five also, I read a piece over the weekend that said one of them apparently was a prison guard, a corrections guard at one time, who had had charges or a complaint filed against him in a physical altercation with an inmate, that he roughed him up and all that. So I, you know, it is, again, why? That's the thing I keep asking myself, why? That's the thing that most of America just wants to do, just wants to know why they chose to do the five to Tyre Nichols, what they did. It almost seems, and I don't mean to put this out there for some wild conjecture, but the reason this reflects badly now on all police, no matter what gender or race you are or level of policing, it almost looks like a pack mentality, like it's late at night, we're going to get somebody and have some sort of sport with it. Just odd. Did you look at the video? Did you watch the video? What did you think? Did the video change your mind in any form? And if you are a law enforcement person, man or a woman, if you want to come on the radio, fine, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Or you can send me an email, paul@WICC600.com, and well, we can chat about this. But again, the big question here is, why? Very simply, why did those five officers do what they did? It almost seems like it was in some way premeditated. I hate to do that, but you look at the video, and could not one or two of these guys have held him down? I mean, I don't get it. I'm not a cop. I never have been. But we're not hearing anything about a stolen vehicle. We're not hearing anything about him leading them on a chase. We're not hearing anything about brandishing a weapon or what cops thought was a weapon. Very bizarre. And a lot of people scratching their heads about this tragic case in Memphis 3 days after a severe police beating. A young man who, you know, from all early indications was not doing anything at all to deserve this, passes away. Five officers fired, charged with, among other things, second-degree murder. You just heard on the news there. A sixth officer now, not fired yet, but on some sort of suspension. A lot of people trying to figure this out. Our next guest, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of New Haven, also former state legislator for a bunch of years, Mike Lawler joins us. Mike, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
I'm good, Mike. Good, Mike. All well and good. Happy New Year to you. Mike, this is a bizarre case. You're not hearing anything, Mike, about, well, he waved a gun or he had a gun or he tried to run down an officer or we had warrants on him, felony warrants, Class A felony. Isn't this a bizarre case?
Yeah, it's bizarre, but... And keep in mind, we don't know the entire story yet, but we know a lot of the whole story. But, I mean, I think what you see here is a sequence of events which starts by a motor vehicle stop for reasons which aren't really clear. Apparently, the officers said after the fact that they thought the guy was driving recklessly, right? But the video that we can see, it doesn't really start until after he's been stopped. But almost immediately, the officers are threatening to shoot him in very explicit terms, I might add. And they're wrestling and pulling him out of the car, and he ends up on the ground. Now they're wrestling around some more. They start spraying him with pepper spray. They tase him a couple of times. Then he takes off and runs. And after that, when they catch him, is when the real serious assault takes place. And so it's a series of escalating events. And it is worth noting that in almost every police department in the country these days, officers are trained in de-escalation, how to take it down several notches. And so obviously that did not happen here.
And Mike, they named this unit the Scorpion Unit. It was an acronym for a very long title. And I guess from what I read, a lot of cities do have these kinds of units that, I guess, Mike, from the face of this, they go after the hardened kind of urban criminality here. You surprised with the fact that this happened with one of those units or not?
No, I mean, most cities have something like this, right? They have, it's considered sort of like hotspots policing. You know where the high crime neighborhoods are. You put a lot of undercover officers in there and you tell them to, you know, focus on suspicious activity and try and figure out quickly, are these armed gangbangers or something else, right? And so it kind of makes sense in theory, but this kind of approach runs the risk of going off the rails, which is clearly what happened here. And so it's an appropriate tactic if you've got the right kind of supervision and standards and training that go along with it. What's very clear here, there was no supervisor anywhere in the mix at any point where this was going down, which is a big, a big mistake in terms of how police departments typically run themselves. So that there's a number of things here, but that's one of them.
Former East Haven Democratic State Rep, now longtime professor of criminal justice, Mike Lawler, joining us from the University of New Haven to talk about this. Well, first of all, above everything else, it's tragic that somebody lost his life here from a police involved beating here 3 days after this young man, Tyree Nichols, was for some reason stopped by five members eventually of the Memphis Police Department. Mike, you mentioned something I wanted to highlight here because I think you're right. I've also heard this over the weekend from experts and even on this morning show on WICC, the fact that in some cases like this or in certain areas, a supervisor is notified or after there's a tough time with an arrestee, you know, there should be some sort of supervisory role notified. Talk about that a little. When they say that, what does that exactly mean?
Well, that means someone needs to respond in addition to the initial officer. So maybe it's a sergeant, maybe a higher ranking person, but someone who's more senior, who in theory can order officers to do certain things, right? And that did not happen here. You know, and there's one thing that I picked up watching those videos the other day, and people listening, if they've seen the videos, if they want to look, the first of the series of 10-minute videos at the very end at the 10-minute mark, what you see is one of the two officers says to the other officer, I hope they stomp this guy's ass when they get him. And then he repeats that a second time. Now, the guy who's saying that, I believe, is the sixth person who was relieved of his duties today. Because he didn't actually participate in the beating. He was actually a white cop. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but yeah. I mean, like he and the other cop who's a black cop, they're talking to each other. The guy has taken off. They had been involved in this wrestling match with the guy at the scene where the pepper spray was used. The black cop gets the pepper spray in the face during the tussle. The white cop loses his eyeglasses. In the aftermath, everyone's chasing after the guy, but they're left behind to deal with their situation. So it's during that process that the white cop, again, who did not go after the guy, says to the black cop, they better stomp his ass when they get him, and then repeats that. And what that says to me, that's an indication of sort of a culture thing, almost like it's an expectation that if you run from the cops or you don't abide by their orders, that what you're going to get is a beatdown after they catch you, which is exactly what happened. So I think there you get to see part of the problem, at least on the Memphis PD, where there was this is what you get if you take off or getting a high speed chase, for example. I'm friends with a lot of cops. I've heard this kind of thing over the years. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's new. I don't think it's unique to Memphis, but that tells a lot about what happened here.
Mike, obviously, you're also a practicing attorney, and you have a law background. We haven't heard much, Mike, from the lawyers yet, but I think we got a little bit of an inkling as to what the possible defense could be. You may have heard this soundbite from one of the attorneys representing one of the officers, and all he said, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but I heard this over the weekend, the attorney said, nobody intended, or my client did not intend for it to end this way, or we didn't want this to end in a loss of life. Well, okay, obviously that's law school 101, but any inkling here, Mike? Now, we're going to put you on the attorney side here. If you had to defend these officers in any way, do you say, well, things just got out of hand, my client was in no position to stop this? I mean, do we harken back to some of the Derek Chauvin thing, too? What do you think legally on this?
Well, I think you're going to see finger-pointing among the officers. Like, I'm not the one who delivered the blows that caused his death, right? So I think you're going to see that. But the other thing is that defense that you were mentioning is a defense to a first-degree murder charge where you'd have to prove they intended to cause his death, right? But they're charged with something that's usually referred to as recklessness. It's like you're aware of a real risk that if you do this, you might end up dead, and you do it anyways. That's recklessness. And so that will get you convicted of manslaughter in Connecticut and murder second degree in Tennessee. And you know, by way of comparison, there's a Connecticut state trooper who's charged with this manslaughter first degree in Connecticut for shooting a young guy in West Haven after a chase. Similar circumstances. And he's not charged with murder, but he's charged with that. Didn't really specifically intend to cause his death, but he ran that risk, and you know, so it's, and I say that because some of the folks in Connecticut defending that trooper said, well, he didn't leave his home that morning with the intention of killing someone. I'm sure he didn't.
Yeah.
But in the moment, that's what ended up happening, and he was not following, in my opinion at least, as is the case with the Memphis officers, not following the training and guidance and standards in the law that govern these kinds of things.
And yeah, that does harken back, Mike, to how you charge someone, or their political pressures to charge. I think the Angela Corey charging in Florida of George Zimmerman that time, you know, she went, you know, a lot of people said, well, if he went with manslaughter, at least in Florida, he still would be in jail today. But they went with a murder charge, and he's and he's out walking around. So I get what you're saying. Now, does Tennessee not have a manslaughter charge in that case? Does it have to be second-degree murder, do you know, or not?
Yeah. Well, see, it different states have different names for the same crime. So in Connecticut, that exact crime would be called manslaughter first degree. There, it's called murder second. It's not what they call malice aforethought or premeditated. It's just something that happens in the moment. But your goal may not have been to kill him, right? But you should have known that's what was going to happen if you did what you did, and or at least there was a high risk it was going to happen. So I teach students this, right? You can commit a homicide and it's not even a crime, right? And you can commit a homicide and it's an accident. You didn't intend to do it, but it's still a crime. Maybe it's manslaughter. Maybe it's negligent homicide. It depends on what lawyers refer to as mens rea. What was your state of mind? And prosecutors have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And so here it seems relatively easy to prove that in this case.
Mike, final question. Boy, this is another one of these cases that look at the span of 30-something years from Rodney King, from where body cams were almost unheard of back then because there was no electronic miniaturization, and the only video we kept seeing over and over and over again was the video on TV, on CNN. First, a short version that looked like it would convict all the officers, and then a longer version that helped in their defense, their eventual acquittal on most of the stuff. But boy, Mike, if we didn't have body cams in this case, I hazard to think there might be nothing going on right now.
Well, you could say the same thing about George Floyd, right?
Yeah.
If were that not on video, I'm sure the narrative would have been completely different and no one would have got charged. But you mentioned Rodney King. It's important. Yes, those officers got found not guilty in the state court, but then they got tried in federal court, and they all ended up in federal prison.
Yeah.
But that's changed everything for police. And the best part and the important part to stress is, like, the vast majority of the police officers know what the rules are and abide by them and do their jobs in good faith, right? But the outliers are much more likely to get caught, and I think you're seeing that in Memphis.
Mike, thank you. Mike Lawler, former state legislator, currently longtime criminal justice professor at the University of New Haven. Mike, we'll undoubtedly have you back on this. Thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Paul. See ya.
All right, thank you. There you go. Yeah, the evolution of the body cam. Our next guest holds the William P. Harris Chair in Military History at Hillsdale's College. His past academic appointments include the Kim T. Anderson Chair of Insurgency and Terrorism at the U.S. Marine Corps University and fellowships at the Joint Special Ops University and Texas A&M. As well, the name of the new book is Triumph Regained, the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1968, a war that is still discussed and debated, maybe even more than the Civil War, World War One, and World War II. Mark Moyer is the guest. He joins us. Hey, Mark, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great. Great to be here.
Thanks for the time. Appreciate it. Your books I'm seeing here are very insightful and good studies into the military history here. This is the second book you've authored here, at least two, on Vietnam, right?
Yes. I previously wrote a book called Triumph Forsaken, which takes the war from 1954 up till the middle of 65 when the U.S. gets in. And that book was published 17 years ago. I ended up getting pulled in Iraq and Afghanistan in the Trump administration, and so it took me a while to get back to this. But there is a lot of new findings in this that I think will be of interest to people.
So let's talk about that because, you know, Mark, as I said in your intro, I think there's really more of a unanimity of thought on the Civil War, on World War One and World War Two, than there is on Vietnam, because this thing is still debated today by historians, by authors like yourself, by a number of gentlemen and some women in support roles that actually served in Vietnam. And now that that age of veteran is slowly starting to fall to lower numbers here. When you mean by triumph regained and looking, when you say that triumph regained and looking ahead, what are your thoughts here?
Yes, you have this massive split within the baby boom generation over Vietnam, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you have there's one section of the baby boom generation that doesn't go to Vietnam, and they feel obliged to justify that decision, and so they have gone out of their way to paint Vietnam War in the worst way, and they've largely had their way because they tend to dominate the academic profession and the media. And you know, if you look at American universities from between the 60s and now, the political right has almost disappeared from the media. And I think that has colored a lot what we think about Vietnam. So I think a big part of why I wrote this is because I think Vietnam veterans have been given a raw deal by history. And I talk about how in this first part of the war, first part of the American part of the war with the U.S. troops fighting, it's incredible just the military achievements they're able to reach. And between when they come in the middle of 65 and the end of 68, the North Vietnamese army has been almost completely destroyed in the South Vietnam.
And again, Mark Moyer, the anti-Vietnam person back then, the person who avoided the war, the rock and roll stars, these celebrities who were anti-Vietnam, you know, they were lionized back then. Anybody who took your stance on this, you know, probably would have been shouted out at least by a lot of society.
Yes, and it's, as the journalist Tom Wolfe once noted, Vietnam's really the first time that we have the people who don't go to war being portrayed or respected in much of society as being actually the people who did a good job. And, it's, especially in the hindsight of what we know, and, we were fighting against this terrible ideology called communism, which killed 100 million people in the 20th century. It's really staggering to try to continue that fiction that, it was actually the morally superior thing to do, to go and to, stay home in comfort rather than to go over in the jungles of Southeast Asia and risking losing your life. And, I do think we've fortunately as a society sort of slowly recognized it probably wasn't such a great idea to blame the troops who went over there for what happened. It was, politicians who sent them there in the first place. And as I argue, while it made sense to fight for Vietnam, that politicians, especially Lyndon Johnson, made critical mistakes and missed critical strategic opportunities.
Has decades of thinking about Vietnam and America's involvement in the Vietnam War, has that been warped by not paying attention to the facts or getting involved in the politics of the whole thing through the elites and the entertainment world? Our guest Mark Moyer talks about that and more. New book, Triumph Regain, The Vietnam War, The Middle Years, he's talking about here, 1965 to 1968. And Mark, you say that you have found new information here, stuff that may surprise people, even from some North Vietnamese sources as well. Elaborate on that, please. Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, some of the most important finds from the book do come from the North Vietnamese sources. And these oftentimes confirm what, in fact, the hawks in the United States were saying. So, for example, the anti-war movement in this country and the people who've gone on to write about it, they argued that the Americans grossly inflated the body count of the North Vietnamese, that we were really claiming that we were doing all this damage to the enemy, but we really weren't. And the North Vietnamese sources actually confirm that, in fact, they were sustaining crippling, horrific losses. And especially, I highlight in 1968, there's a famous Tet Offensive, and that part is well known, but there's two more offensives in May and August of 1968, mm-hmm. called the second and the third waves, and they take even more devastating losses in those, which again helps account for the fact that they've been pretty much destroyed in the South by the end of 1968.
During the Johnson years and even the early Kennedy years, when we first got committed to this, and you say back in the 50s as well, the Johnson years after the Kennedy years, the political calculus of this, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember as a little kid growing up, you know, watching the CBS Evening News and watching Walter Cronkite and all these network newscasts, there was the war story, but there was also the political calculus and what the administration was saying and LBJ was saying, and we now know all the internals are there. That really, as I remember, Mark, being a little kid, there rarely was a discussion of actually how American troops were doing alongside the South Vietnamese without a discussion of, well, hey, what does this mean for LBJ?
Yes, and that is one of the biggest problems with LBJ throughout this. And it starts in 1964 when he tells the American people as he's running for president that he's not going to send American boys to fight wars that Asian boys and fight for themselves. Now, it turns out he knew all along that he might be doing that in 1965, but he, you know, I think it's clear now, was being rather dishonest and lying in order to win election, and then he wanted to do these things. But then, you know, after that, there's a number of other falsehoods that he provides, and so this will help contribute to public dissatisfaction. But Johnson also will admit that he basically didn't sell the war to the American people or explain what's going on, because he was more interested in his so-called Great Society, which mm-hmm. was going to, you know, eliminate poverty by, you know, the middle of the 1970s.
What kind of pressure, Mark Moyer, was LBJ getting, not necessarily out front, that the major networks and the Washington Post and the New York Times and America could soak in and report on? I would imagine there was a lot of diplomatic back channeling on this. What, if anything, did you find out about how LBJ and his administration were handling what many of our allies were saying or maybe not saying?
Well, initially, one of the interesting things that people don't know is that in 1965, America's allies are overwhelmingly telling Johnson that the U.S. has to save South Vietnam, and if they don't, that all of Southeast Asia is going to fall to communism. And then turns out Indonesia in fall of 65, there's a momentous struggle there, and Vietnam is instrumental in helping the anti-communists prevail there. But, you know, from there on, Johnson is facing pressures from hawks and doves within his own administration. The hawks, mainly military officers who are saying we've got to do more. And then he's got doves who are saying, well, we don't want to do too much and we're going to, you know, upset the Chinese and the Soviets. And this is another area where the communist sources are revealing, because they actually show us that China and the Soviet Union were not interested, in fact, in going to fight the Americans in Vietnam. And so the notion that was pushed by the doves that we need to tread very carefully, and it turns out to have been false.
I have to ask you, will there be another edition, Mark, maybe, perhaps looking at the final years of the war from 68 on?
Yes, there will be. The final volume will pick up with the Nixon presidency and go through to the tragic end in 1975.
Yeah, those last days, that airlift is etched in people's minds. Just let me ask you real quickly before we go over the particulars of the book again. The way that Nixon handled it and Henry Kissinger, he made that a major campaign point, didn't he? Saying, hey, I know what I'm doing here. I have the foreign policy chops. I can get us out of there, right?
Yes, and Nixon did think he could negotiate an end to the war within his first year in office. And for a number of reasons, he ends up not being able to do that. And, I think South Vietnam still could have survived had it not been for Watergate. But once Watergate happens and Nixon is stripped of power, there's just no way for the United States to keep up support for South Vietnam.
All right, that'll be in part three. Part two now has been written, Triumph Regained, the Vietnam War 1965 to 1968. Mark Moyer has been the guest, M-O-Y-A-R, Mark Moyer. See this book, the first book he wrote on Vietnam, and all his other military history and strategy books, of course, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your local bookseller. Mark, thank you. Appreciate it. And make sure you come back with part three, okay?
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. All right. There you folks go. And if, again, you are a Vietnam veteran, and I guess if you're a Vietnam veteran, the youngest you can be is, let's say, mid-70s is when maybe the majority of Vietnam vets returned home and left the service. So let's say 75, that's 25, and then 23 would be 68, so I'm guessing, you tell me, the youngest Vietnam vets, maybe 73, 74, 75. So if you are interested, if your father may want to read this, if you have anybody in the family, this is the second book here, Triumph Regained, the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1968.